Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, Pulpeteers, and welcome to issue 22 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast that each week enhances your worldliness and refinement, provides countless conversation starters for the dinner table or those uncomfortable first dates, and generally amplifies the awesome in your world by presenting a fabulous pulp story directly into your ears. Snappy intros are provided at no additional cost by me, Dave Robison, your host and friendly native guide. You're welcome. Now, as you are no doubt aware, the PPP has been rocking the podosphere, bringing quality tales of the pulp era back into the mainstream. Well, okay, we may not be mainstream, but we're at least a trendy tributary that ultimately feeds into the ocean of awesome, right? I mean, we've offered some classic tales and some that are deep in the hinterlands of the pulp frontier. Well, this week, we are pleased once again to rock your world and deliver another pulp fiction first. In a literary form that is dominated by male writers, there is one woman who shattered the gender barriers of fantasy and science fiction. Her name was Catherine Lee Moore, perhaps better known as C.L. Moore. And today, Protecting Project Pulp is delighted to offer her tale, The Tree of Life, for your enjoyment. The Tree of Life was first published in Weird Tales in October of 1936, and it's a long one, so we've broken it up into two parts. Please don't hate us. As a child, C.L. Moore suffered from poor health and spent much of her time cooped up in her bed reading. Now, ultimately, she went to college but left during the Great Depression to work as a secretary. There, she started cultivating her literary chops, and her work started appearing in pulp magazines in the 1930s. She made a splash in Weird Tales with two significant series of stories, one about a spacefaring rogue named Northwest Smith, the protagonist of today's story, and the other is a short fantasy series about Jurel of Jewry, one of the first female protagonists in the sword and sorcery genre. In fact, the first of the Jurel of Jewry stories, Black God's Kiss, received the cover illustration for Weird Tales in the October 1934 edition. Moore's work also appeared in Astounding Science Fiction magazine throughout the 1940s, and several stories published there were later collected in her first published book, Judgment Night, published by Gnome Press in 1952. Now, you may remember a month or so ago, we ran a story by Henry Kuttner titled Raider of the Spaceways about a telepathic plant on Venus. Well, apparently Kuttner was a big fan of Moore's. He even wrote her a fan letter, thinking she was a man. Now, apparently, she forgave him, because they married in 1940. Now, I have more to share about this remarkable writer, but I'll save that for next week. Now, your narrator for this week's story is a repeat offender here at the PPP, Jeff Lane. Jeff is the author of the novels This Paper World and One Way, a number of short stories, and the forthcoming novella Crush Depth. He podcasts his fiction at jefflaneaudiobooks.com, as well as at iTunes and Podiobooks. We hope you'll all check out his work after you're done here, of course. Now, I hope you've realized by now that the world is much larger, much stranger than it appears. Amid the smooth, gleaming surface, you'll find tiny cracks, fractures in the continuum that defines our reality. And if you're not very, very careful, those cracks might widen and swallow you whole. ¶¶
Over time-ruined Ilar, the search planes swooped and circled. Northwest Smith, peering up at them with a steel-pale stare from the shelter of a half-collapsed temple, thought of vultures wheeling above Carrion. All day long now they had been raking these ruins for him. Presently, he knew thirst would begin to parch his throat and hunger to gnaw at him. There was neither food nor water in these ancient Martian ruins, and he knew that it could only be a matter of time before the urgencies of his own body would drive him out to signal those wheeling patrol ships and trade his hard-won liberty for food and drink. He crouched lower under the shadow of the temple arch and cursed the accuracy of the patrol gunner, whose flame blast had caught his dodging ship just at the edge of Ilar's ruins. Presently, it occurred to him that in most Martian temples of the ancient days, an ornamental well had stood in the outer court for the benefit of wayfarers. Of course, all water in it would be a million years dry now, but for lack of anything better to do, he rose from his seat at the edge of the collapsed central dome and made his cautious way by still intact corridors toward the front of the temple. He paused in a tangle of wreckage at the courtyard's edge and looked out across the sun-drenched expanse of pavement toward that ornate well that once had served travelers who passed by here in the days when Mars was a green planet. It was an unusually elaborate well and amazingly well preserved. Its rim had been inlaid with a mosaic pattern whose symbolism must once have borne deep meaning, and above it, in a great fan of time-defying bronze, an elaborate grillwork portrayed the inevitable Tree of Life pattern, which so often appears in the symbolism of the three worlds. Smith looked at it a bit incredulously from his shelter. It was so miraculously preserved amidst all the chaos of broken stone, casting a delicate tracery of shadow on the sunny pavement, as perfectly as it must have done a million years ago when dusty travelers paused here to drink. He could picture them, filing in at noontime through the great gates that... The vision vanished abruptly as his questing eyes made the circle of the ruined walls. There had been no gate. He could find not a trace of it anywhere around the outer wall of the court. The only entrance here, as nearly as he could tell from the foundations that remained, had been the door in whose ruins he now stood. Queer. This must have been a private court then, its great grill-crowned well reserved for the use of the priests. Or wait, had there not been a priest King Ilar after whom the city was named? A wizard king, so the legend said, who ruled temple as well as palace with an iron hand. This elaborately patterned well of material royal enough to withstand the weight of ages might well have been sacrosanct for the use of that long-dead monarch. It might. Across the sun-bright pavement swept the shadow of a plane. Smith dodged back into deeper hiding while the ship circled low over the courtyard. And it was then, as he crouched against a crumbled wall and waited motionless for the danger to pass, that he became aware for the first time of a sound that startled him so he could scarcely credit his ears. A recurrent sound, choked and sorrowful, the sound of a woman sobbing. The incongruity of it made him forgetful for a moment of the peril hovering overhead in the sun-hot outdoors. The dimness of the temple ruins became a living and vital place for that moment, throbbing with the sound of tears. He looked about, half in incredulity, wondering if hunger and thirst were playing tricks on him already, or if these broken halls might be haunted by a million-years-old sorrow that wept along the corridors to drive its hearers mad. There were tales of such haunters in some of Mars' older ruins. The hair prickled faintly at the back of his neck as he laid a hand on the butt of his force gun and commenced a cautious prowl toward the source of the muffled noise. Presently, he caught a flash of white, luminous in the gloom of these ruined walls, and went forward with soundless steps, eyes narrowed in the effort to make out what manner of creature this might be that wept alone in time-forgotten ruins. It was a woman. Or it had the dim outlines of a woman huddled against an angle of fallen walls and veiled in a fabulous shower of long, dark hair. But there was something uncannily odd about her. He could not focus his pale stare upon her outlines. She was scarcely more than a luminous blot of whiteness in the gloom, shimmering with a look of unreality which the sound of her sobs denied. Before he could make up his mind just what to do, something must have warned the weeping girl that she was no longer alone, for the sound of her tears checked suddenly, and she lifted her head, turning to him a face no more distinguishable than her body's outlines. He made no effort to resolve the blurred features into visibility, for out of that luminous mask burned two eyes that caught his with an almost perceptible impact and gripped them in a stare from which he could not have turned if he would. They were the most amazing eyes he had ever met, colored like moonstone, milky translucent, so that they looked almost blind, and that magnetic stare held him motionless. In the instant that she gripped him with that fixed, moonstone look, he felt oddly as if a tangible bond were taut between them. Then she spoke, and he wondered if his mind, after all, had begun to give way in the haunted loneliness of dead Ilar. For the words she spoke fell upon his ears in a gibberish of meaningless sound, yet in his brain a message formed with a clarity that far transcended the halting communication of words. And her milky colored eyes bore into his with a fierce intensity.
"I'm lost. I'm lost,"
wailed the voice in his brain. A rush of sudden tears brimmed the compelling eyes, veiling their brilliance. And he was free again with that clouding of the moonstone surfaces. Her voice wailed, but the words were meaningless, and no knowledge formed in his brain to match them. Stiffly, he stepped back a pace and looked down at her, a feeling of helpless incredulity rising within him. For he still could not focus directly upon the shining whiteness of her, and nothing, save those moonstone eyes, were clear to him. The girl sprang to her feet and rose on tiptoe, gripping his shoulders with urgent hands. Again, the blind intensity of her eyes took hold of his, with a force almost as tangible as the clutch of her hands. Again, that stream of intelligence poured into his brain, strongly, pleadingly.
"Please, please take me back. I'm so frightened. I can't find my way. Oh, please."
He blinked down at her, his dazed mind gradually realizing the basic facts of what was happening. Obviously, her milky, unseeing eyes held a magnetic power that carried her thoughts to him without the need of common speech. And they were the eyes of a powerful mind, the outlets from which a stream of fierce energy poured into his brain. Yet the words they conveyed were the words of a terrified and helpless girl. A strong sense of wariness was rising in him as he considered the incongruity of speech and power, both of which were beating upon him more urgently with every breath. The mind of a forceful and strong-willed woman carrying the sobs of a frightened girl. There was no sincerity in it.
"Please, please,"
cried her impatience in his brain.
"Help me. Guide me back."
"Back where?" he heard his own voice asking.
"The tree."
Wailing that queer speech in his brain, while gibberish was all his ears heard, and the moonstone stare transfixed him strongly.
"The tree of life. Oh, take me back to the shadow of the tree."
A vision of the grill-ornamented well leaped into his memory. It was the only tree symbol he could think of just then. But what possible connection could there be between the well and the lost girl, if she was lost? Another wail in that unknown tongue, another anguished shake of his shoulders, brought a sudden resolution into his groping mind. There could be no harm in leading her back to the well, to whose grill she must surely be referring. and strong curiosity was growing in his mind. Much more than met the eye was concealed in this queer incident, and a wild guess had flashed through his mind that perhaps she might have come from some subterranean world into which the well descended. It would explain her luminous pallor, if not her blurriness, and, too, her eyes did not seem to function in the light. There was a much more incredible explanation of her presence, but he was not to know it for a few minutes yet. "Come along," he said, taking the clutching hands gently from his shoulders. "I'll lead you to the well." She sighed in a deep gust of relief and dropped her compelling eyes from his, murmuring in that strange, gabbling tongue what must have been thanks. He took her by the hand and turned toward the ruined archway of the door. Against his fingers, her flesh was cool and firm. To the touch, she was tangible, but even thus near, his eyes refused to focus upon the cloudy opacity of her body, the dark blur of her streaming hair. Nothing but those burning, blinding eyes were strong enough to pierce the veil that parted them. She stumbled along at his side over the rough floor of the temple, saying nothing more, panting with eagerness to return to her incomprehensible tree. How much of that eagerness was assumed, Smith still could not be quite sure. When they reached the door, he halted her for a moment, scanning the sky for danger. Apparently the ships had finished with this quarter of the city, for he could see two or three of them half a mile away, hovering low over Ilara's northern section. He could risk it without much peril. He led the girl cautiously out into the sun-hot court. She could not have known by sight that they were near the well, but when they were within 20 paces of it, she flung up her blurred head suddenly and tugged at his hand. It was she who led him that last stretch which parted the two from the well. In the sun, the shadow tracery of the grill's symbolic pattern lay vividly outlined on the ground. The girl gave a little gasp of delight. She dropped his hand and ran forward 3 short steps and plunged into the very center of that shadowy pattern on the ground. And what happened then was too incredible to believe. The pattern ran over her like a garment, curving to the curve of her body in the way all shadows do. But as she stood there, striped and laced with the darkness of it, there came a queer shifting in the lines of black tracery, a subtle, inexplicable movement to one side. And with that motion, she vanished. It was exactly as if that shifting had moved her out of one world and into another. Stupidly, Smith stared at the spot from which she had disappeared. Then, several things happened almost simultaneously. The zoom of a plane broke suddenly into the quiet, a black shadow dipped low over the rooftops, and Smith, too late, realized that he stood defenseless in full view of the searching ships. There was only one way out, and that way too fantastic to put faith in, but he had no time to hesitate. With one leap, he plunged full into the midst of the shadow of the Tree of Life. Its tracery flowed round him, molding its pattern to his body, and outside the boundaries, everything executed a queer little sidewise dip and slipped in the most extraordinary manner, like an optical illusion, into quite another scene. There was no intervention of blackness. It was as if he looked through the bars of a grill upon a picture which, without warning, slipped sidewise, while between the bars appeared another scene, a curious dim landscape, gray, as if with the twilight of early evening. The air had an oddly thickened look, through which he saw the quiet trees and the flower-spangled grass of the place with a queer, unreal blending, like the landscape in a tapestry, all its outlines blurred. In the midst of this tapestried twilight, the burning whiteness of the girl he had followed blazed like a flame. She had paused a few steps away and stood waiting, apparently quite sure that he would come after. He grinned a little to himself as he realized it, knowing that curiosity must almost certainly have driven him in her wake, even if the necessity for shelter had not compelled his following. She was clearly visible now, in this thickened dimness, visible and very lovely, and a little unreal. She shone with a burning clarity, the only vivid thing in the whole twilight world. Eyes upon that blazing whiteness, Smith stepped forward, scarcely realizing that he had moved. Slowly, he crossed the dark grass toward her. The grass was soft underfoot, and thick with small, low-blooming flowers of a shining pallor. Botticelli painted such spangled swards for the feet of his angels. Upon it, the girl's bare feet gleamed whiter than the blossoms. She wore no garment but the royal mantle of her hair, sweeping about her in a cloak of shining darkness that had a queer, unreal tinge of purple in that low light. It brushed her ankles in its fabulous length. From the hood of it, she watched Smith coming toward her, a smile on her pale mouth, and a light blazing in the deeps of her moonstone eyes. She was not blind now, nor frightened. She stretched out her hand to him, confidently.
"It is my turn now to lead you," she smiled.
As before, the words were gibberish, but the penetrating stare of those strange white eyes gave them a meaning in the depths of his brain. Automatically, his hand went out to hers. He was a little dazed, and her eyes were compelling. Her fingers twined in his, and she set off over the flowery grass, pulling him beside her. He did not ask where they were going. Lost in the dreamy spell of the still, gray, enchanted place, he felt no need for words. He was beginning to see more clearly in that odd, blurring twilight that ran the outlines of things together in that queer, tapestried manner, and he puzzled in a futile, muddled way as he went on over what sort of land he'd come into. Overhead was darkness, paling into twilight near the ground, so that when he looked up, he was staring into bottomless deeps of starless night. Trees and flowering shrubs and the flower-starred grass stretched emptily about them in the thick, confusing gloom of the place. He could see only a little distance through that dim air. It was as if they walked a strip of tapestried twilight in some unlighted dream, and the girl, with her lovely, luminous body and richly colored robe of hair, was like a woman in a tapestry too, unreal and magical. After a while, when he had become a little adjusted to the queerness of the whole scene, he began to notice furtive movements in the shrubs and trees they passed. Things flickered too swiftly for him to catch their outlines, but from the tail of his eye, he was aware of motion, and somehow of eyes that watched. That sensation was a familiar one to him, and he kept an uneasy gaze on those shiftings in the shrubbery as they went on. Presently, he caught a watcher in full view between bush and tree, and saw that it was a man, a little furtive, dark-skinned man who dodged hastily back into cover again before Smith's eyes could do more than take in the fact of his existence. After that, he knew what to expect and could make them out more easily. Little darting people with big eyes that shone with a queer, sorrowful darkness from their small, frightened faces as they scuttled through the bushes, dodging always just out of plain sight among the leaves. He could hear the soft rustle of their passage, and once or twice when they passed near a clump of shrubbery, he thought he caught the echo of little whispering calls, gentle as the rustle of leaves and somehow full of a strange warning note so clear that he caught it even amid the murmur of their speech. Warning calls, and little furtive hiders in the leaves, and a landscape of tapestried, blurred, carpeted with Botticelli flower-strewn sward. It was all a dream. He felt quite sure of that. It was a long while before curiosity awakened him sufficiently to make him break the stillness. But at last he asked dreamily, "Where are we going?" The girl seemed to understand that, without the necessity of the bond her hypnotic eyes made, for she turned and caught his eyes in a white stare and answered,
"To Thag. Thag desires you."
"What is Thag?" In answer to that, she launched, without preliminary, upon a little sing-song monologue of explanation whose stereotyped formula made him faintly uneasy with the thought that it must have been made very often to attain the status of a set speech, made to many men, perhaps, whom Thag desired. And what became of them afterward, he wondered. But the girl was speaking.
Many ages ago there dwelt in Ilar the great King Ilar, for whom the city was named. He was a magician of mighty power, but not mighty enough to fulfill all his ambitions. So, by his arts, he called up out of darkness the being known as Thag, and with him struck a bargain. By that bargain, Thag was to give of his limitless power, serving Ilar all the days of Ilar's life, and in return, the king was to create a land for Thag's dwelling place, and people it with slaves, and furnish a priestess to tend Thag's needs. This is that land. I am that priestess, the latest of a long line of women born to serve Thag. The tree people are his lesser servants. I've spoken softly so that the tree people do not hear, for to them, Thag is the center and focus of creation, the end and beginning of all life. But to you, I have told the truth.
But what does Thag want of me?
It is not for Thag's servants to question Thag.
Then what becomes, afterward, of the men Thag desires? He pursued.
You must ask Thag that.
She turned her eyes away as she spoke, snapping the mental bond that had flowed between them with a suddenness that left Smith dizzy. He went on at her side more slowly, pulling back a little on the tug of her fingers. By degrees, the sense of dreaminess was fading, and alarm began to stir in the deeps of his mind. After all, there was no reason why he need let this blank-eyed priestess lead him up to the very maw of her god. She had lured him into this land by what he knew now to have been a trick. Might she not have worse tricks than that in store for him? She held him, after all, by nothing stronger than the clasp of her fingers, if he could keep his eyes turned from hers. Therein lay her real power, but he could fight it if he chose. And he began to hear more clearly than ever the queer note of warning in the rustling whispers of the tree folk who still fluttered in and out of sight among the leaves. The twilight place had taken on menace and evil. Suddenly, he made up his mind. He stopped, breaking the clasp of the girl's hand. I'm not going, he said. She swung round in a sweep of richly tinted hair, words jetting from her in a gush of incoherence. But he dared not meet her eyes, and they conveyed no meaning to him. Resolutely he turned away, ignoring her voice, and set out to retrace the way they had come. She called after him once, in a high, clear voice that somehow held a note as warning as that in the rustling voices of the tree people. But he kept on, doggedly, not looking back. She laughed then, sweetly and scornfully, a laugh that echoed uneasily in his mind, long after the sound of it had died upon the twilight air. After a while, he glanced back over one shoulder, half expecting to see the luminous dazzle of her body still glowing in the dim glade where he had left her. But the blurred tapestry landscape was quite empty. He went on in the midst of a silence so deep it hurt his ears, and in a solitude unhaunted even by the shy presence of the tree folk. They had vanished with the fire-bright girl, and the whole twilight land was empty, save for himself. He plodded on across the dark grass, crushing the upturned flower faces under his boots, and asking himself wearily if he could be mad. There seemed little other explanation for this hushed and tapestried solitude that had swallowed him up. In that thunderous quiet, in that deathly solitude, he went on. When he had walked for what seemed to him much longer than it should have taken to reach his starting point, and still no sign of an exit appeared, he began to wonder if there were any way out of the gray land of Thag. For the first time, he realized that he had come through no tangible gateway. He'd only stepped out of a shadow, and, now that he thought of it, there were no shadows here. The grayness swallowed everything up, leaving the landscape oddly flat, like a badly drawn picture. He looked about helplessly, quite lost now, and not sure in what direction he should be facing. For there was nothing here by which to know directions. The trees and shrubs and starry grass still stretched about him, uncertainly outlined in that changeless dusk. They seemed to go on forever. But he plodded ahead, unwilling to stop because of a queer tension in the air, somehow as if all the blurred trees and shrubs were waiting in breathless anticipation, centering upon his stumbling figure. But all trace of animate life had vanished with the disappearance of the priestess's white glowing figure. Head down, paying little heed to where he was going, he went on over the flowery sward. An odd sense of voids about him startled Smith at last out of his lethargic plodding. He lifted his head. He stood, just at the edge of a line of trees, dim and indistinct in the unchanging twilight. Beyond them, he came to himself with a jerk and stared incredulously. Beyond them, the grass ran down to nothingness, merging by imperceptible degrees into a streaked and arching void. Not the sort of emptiness into which a material body could fall, but a solid nothing, curving up toward the dark zenith as the inside of a sphere curves. No physical thing could have entered there. It was too utterly void, an inviolable emptiness which no force could invade. He stared up along the inward arch of that curving, impassable wall. Here, then, was the edge of the queer land Alar had wrested out of space itself. This arch must be the curving of solid space which had been bent awry to enclose the magical land. There was no escape this way. He could not even bring himself to approach any nearer to that streaked and arching blank. He could not have said why, but it woke in him an inner disquiet so strong that after a moment staring, he turned his eyes away. Presently, he shrugged and set off along the inside of the line of trees which parted him from the space wall. Perhaps there might be a break somewhere. It was a forlorn hope, but the best that offered. Wearily, he stumbled on over the flowery grass. How long he had gone on along that almost imperceptibly curving line of border, he could not have said. But after a timeless interval of gray solitude, he gradually became aware that a tiny rustling and whispering among the leaves had been growing louder by degrees for some time. He looked up. In and out among the trees which bordered that solid wall of nothingness, little, indistinguishable figures were flitting. The tree men had returned. Queerly grateful for their presence, he went on a bit more cheerfully, paying no heed to their timid dartings to and fro, for Smith was wise in the ways of wildlife. Presently, when they saw how little heed he paid them, they began to grow bolder, their whispers louder. And among those rustling voices, he thought he was beginning to catch threads of familiarity. Now and again, a word reached his ears that he seemed to recognize, lost amidst the gibberish of their speech. He kept his head down and his hands quiet, plodding along with a cunning stillness that began to bear results. From the corner of his eye, he could see that a little dark tree man had darted out from cover and paused midway between bush and tree to inspect the queer, tall stranger. Nothing happened to this darting venturer, and soon another risked a pause in the open to stare at the quiet walker among the trees. In a little while, a small crowd of tree people was moving, slowly parallel with his course, staring with all the avid curiosity of wild things at Smith's plodding figure. And among them, the rustling whispers grew louder. Presently, The ground dipped down into a little hollow ringed with trees. It was a bit darker here than it had been on the higher level, and as he went down the slope of its side, he saw that among the underbrush which filled it were cunningly hidden huts, twined together out of the living bushes. Obviously, the hollow was a tiny village where the tree folk dwelt. He was sure of this when they began to grow bolder as he went down into the dimness of the place. The whispers shrilled a little, and the boldest among his watchers ran almost at his elbow, twittering their queer broken speech in hushed syllables, whose familiarity still bothered him with its haunting echoes of words he knew. When he reached the center of the hollow, he became aware that the little folk had spread out in a ring to surround him. Wherever he looked, their small, anxious faces and staring eyes confronted him. He grinned to himself and came to a halt, waiting gravely. None of them seemed quite brave enough to constitute himself spokesman, but among several, a hurried whispering broke out, to which he caught the words, "Thag," and "Danger," and "Beware." He recognized the meaning of these words without placing in his mind their origins in some tongue he knew. He knit his sun-bleached brows and concentrated harder, striving to wrest from that curious murmuring whisper some hints of its original root. He had a smattering of more tongues than he could have counted offhand, and it was hard to place these scattered words among any one speech. But the word "thag" had a sound like that of the very ancient dryland tongue, which upon Mars is considered at once the oldest and the most uncouth of all the planet's languages. And with that clue to guide him, he presently began to catch other syllables which were remotely like syllables from the dryland speech. They were almost unrecognizable, far, far more ancient than the very oldest versions of the tongue he had ever heard repeated, almost primitive in their crudity and simplicity. And for a moment, the sheerest awe came over him as he realized the significance of what he listened to. The dryland race today is a handful of semi-brutes degenerate from the ages of past time when they were a mighty people at the apex of an almost forgotten glory. The day is millions of years gone now, too far in the past to have record save the vaguest folklore, yet here was a people who spoke the rudiments of that race's tongue, as it must have been spoken in the race's beginnings, perhaps a million years earlier, even than that immemorial time of their triumph. The reeling of millenniums set Smith's mind awhirl with the effort at compassing their span. There was another connotation in the speaking of that tongue by these timid bush dwellers, too. It must mean that the forgotten wizard king, Ilar, had peopled this sinister twilight land with the ancestors of today's dryland dwellers. If they shared the same tongue, they must share the same lineage. And humanity's remorseless adaptation had done the rest. It had been no kinder here than in the outside world, where the ancient plainsmen who had roamed Mars' green prairies had dwindled with their dying plains, degenerating at last into a shrunken, leather-skinned bestiality. For here, the same race root had declined into these tiny, slinking creatures, with their dusky skins and great staring eyes and their voices that never rose above a whisper. What tragedies must lie behind that gradual degeneration? All about him, the whispers still ran. He was beginning to suspect that through countless ages of hiding and murmuring, those voices must have lost the ability to speak aloud. And he wondered with a little inward chill what terror it was which had transformed a free and fearless people into these tiny wild things whispering in the underbrush. The little anxious voices had shrilled into vehemence now, all of them chattering together in their queer, soft, rustling whisper. Looking back later upon that timeless space he had passed in the hollow, Smith remembered it as some curious nightmare, dimness and tapestried blurring, and a hush like death over the whole twilight land, and the timid voices whispering, whispering eloquently with terror and warning. He groped back among his memories and brought forth a phrase or two remembered from long ago, an archaic rendering of the immemorial tongue they spoke. It was the simplest version he could remember of the complex speech now used, but he knew that to them it must sound fantastically strange. Instinctively, he whispered as he spoke it, feeling like an actor in a play as he mouthed the ancient idiom. I cannot understand. Speak more slowly. A torrent of words greeted this rendering of their tongue. Then there was a great deal of hushing and hissing, and presently two or three between them began laboriously to recite and involve speech, one syllable at a time. Always two or more shared the task. Never in his converse with them did he address anyone directly. Ages of terror had bred all directness out of them.
"Fag,"
they said.
"Fag the terrible. Fag the omnipotent. Fag the inescapable. Beware of Fag."
For a moment, Smith stood quiet, grinning down at them despite himself. There must not be too much of intelligence left among this branch of the race either, for surely such a warning was superfluous. Yet they had mastered their agonies of timidity to give it. All virtue could not yet have been bred out of them then. They still had kindness and a sort of desperate courage rooted deep in fear. "What is Thag?" he managed to inquire, voicing the archaic syllables uncertainly. And they must have understood the meaning, if not the phraseology, for another spate of whispered tumult burst from the clustering tribe. Then, as before, several took up the task of answering.
"Thag, Thag, the end and the beginning, the center of creation. When Thag breathes, the world trembles. The earth was made for Thag's dwelling place. All things are Thag's. Oh, beware, beware."
This much he pieced together out of their diffuse whisperings, catching up the fragments of words he knew and fitting them into pattern. What is the danger?" he managed to ask.
"Thag hungers. Thag must be fed. It is we who feed him. But there are times when he desires other food than us. It is then he sends his priestess forth to lure food in. Oh, beware of Thag."
"You mean then that she, the priestess, brought me in for food?" A chorus of grave, murmuring affirmations. "Then why did she leave me?"
There is no escape from Thag. Thag is the center of creation. All things are Thag's. When he calls, you must answer. When he hungers, he will have you. Beware of Thag."
Smith considered that for a moment in silence. In the main, he felt confident that he had understood their warning correctly, and he had little reason to doubt that they knew whereof they spoke. Thag might not be the center of the universe, but if they said he could call a victim from anywhere in the land, Smith was not disposed to doubt it. The priestess's willingness to let him leave her unhindered, yes, even her scornful laughter as he looked back, told the same story. Whatever Thag might be, his power in this land could not be doubted. He made up his mind suddenly what he must do, and turned to the breathlessly waiting little folk. "Which way lies Thag?" he asked.
You just heard part one of The Tree of Life by Catherine Lee Moore, read by Jeff Lane. Joss Whedon was once asked, "Why do you keep writing such strong female protagonists?" To which Master Whedon replied, "Because you keep asking that question." Here we are in the 21st century, and we're still wrestling with gender issues. Can you imagine the strength and conviction required for Catherine Moore to not only make the choice to become a writer, but to achieve such success in her craft? Now, my romantic impulses lead me to picture her as a kind of Joan of Arc type of person, uncompromising in her principles, chin held high and eyes flashing as she boldly thrust her first manuscript into the hands of Farnsworth Wright, the editor of Weird Tales at the time. Now, while Wright was described as an excellent editor who recognized quality work, the realist in me points out that Moore is widely known as C.L. Moore, not Catherine or Kate Moore. And that was probably a very shrewd and prudent stratagem on her part. Catherine Moore changed the world, paving the way for every female genre writer that followed her. But here's what really makes me sit up and take notice. She didn't storm the halls of literature. She didn't camp out on the steps of publishing houses in protest. And she didn't shout invectives at the gender stereotypes that had shackled the literary world for so long. Which isn't to say there probably weren't a few heated tirades in the bar or over dinner. She wasn't a saint, after all. But the thing is, I don't think she meant to change the world at all. Catherine Moore was a writer. She's quoted as saying, "Nothing I have ever written was given the slightest deliberation. It was there in the typewriter and it came out, a total bypassing of the brain." Now, those are the words of a true storyteller. They write because they must. To do anything else is unthinkable. She wasn't championing the cause of women's rights. She was doing what she loved. Adopting the pen name C.L. Moore removed the gender issue from her craft altogether and allowed her work to be considered without bias or prejudice. She was doing what she loved, and in doing so, she changed the world. And this is one of the benefits of history. I mean, we can look back and see the choices people made and the outcomes those choices created. Now, in these days where change and challenge and conflict seems to fill our eyes and our ears, I think Catherine Moore's choices give us a very graceful alternative perspective. And I know the team of Protecting Project Pulp is doing exactly that, changing the world one podcast at a time by bringing these fabulous tales we love so much to you each week. Our assistant editor, Fred the Pulp Hound Heimbaugh, has a keen nose for delicious pulp tales. Our sound engineer, Tom Sugartones O'Dwyer, works his magic every week to make our stories sound as sweet as Christmas candy. And our editor and publisher, Tony Crazy Legs Smith, well, he got that nickname after a beach holiday he took last summer. But he's out there every day blazing the trail for fabulous fiction to be put into the ears of people like you who love the stories as much as we do. Now, remember, there's no need to fall through a crack in reality and negotiate with an interdimensional god to get quality pulp tales every week. Just attune your reality to iTunes and subscribe to us there. Or resonate your soul frequency to our website, www.protectingprojectpulp.com. And feel free to leave a psychic impression as a comment on the post or in our forums. I know, it was wicked cruel to tease you with only the first half of the story, but we'll make it up to you next week when we play part two of The Tree of Life by Catherine Lee Moore. Until then, I'm Dave Robison, wishing you nothing but fabulous adventures. I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.